Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to ask a pharmacist about getting naloxone for their first aid kits at home or work. No prescription is needed. Naloxone can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose and restore breathing. Opioidresponse.info.
Glad to have all of you with us for Political Rewind today. I'm Bill Nygut. I hope you all had a good weekend. Easter, many people celebrating the end of Passover for a number of our listeners out there. So a beautiful spring weekend here in the state of Georgia. I want to apologize in advance. We're having some technical problems with my connection. And so I'm talking to you all on the telephone, and I realize the audio quality isn't what we're used to here, but I hope you'll bear with me, and we're doing our best to see if we can fix whatever the issue is. We're going to talk a lot today, of course, about the latest news in the election law that has stirred up so much controversy here across the state of Georgia and also nationally. Let's face it. This is a really hard issue to talk about as respectfully as we always try to do on Political Rewind. Feelings are very, very hot on both sides of the issue. But today, with the panel that we put together for the show, we are going to do our best to walk through the controversy and talk about what's happening as of today. With that in mind, let me introduce our panel. Of course, it's Monday, which means that Jim Galloway, the former political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is with us. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing great. I had a wonderful weekend. Like you said, the weather was wonderful. We've got family together again, so all things were good.
Good. I'm very glad to hear that. We're joined also today by your former colleague at the AJC, Maya Prabhu, who covered the Senate and has been doing. How many years now have you been covering the state Senate, Maya?
3.5. So this is my fourth session.
So you're a real veteran, and you can give us some really interesting insights about what went down in the state Senate as this election law was debated. And speaking of the state Senate, we're joined by Macon State Senator John Kennedy, Republican down there. How are things in Macon today, Senator?
Good morning, Bill. Thanks. It's a beautiful morning in Macon. Everything is good, and it's awfully nice to be home after having been in the legislature for the last 3 months, so it's nice to be home.
I'm sure that's true. You know, somebody, let me introduce and then I'll make the comment I was going to. Our final panelist, Representative B. Gwynn of Atlanta, Democrat from Atlanta. B., thank you for being here today.
Good morning, Bill. I just actually got back from LJ and Blue Ridge, which is Republican territory, and had some delicious North Georgia trout.
Oh, all right. What I was starting to say, but I want to include you in this as well. A number of analysts have pointed out that it isn't just that you all, both in the Senate and the House, had a long and very trying session, given some of the issues that were on the table. It's that you've been going at this really for more than a year. Go all the way back to the session of 2020, which was interrupted by COVID. You came back into session, went right to an election, came out of the election to the runoffs, and then the 2021 session. So, B and John, you're really finally getting a chance maybe to take a little break. Is that fair to say, John?
Yes, Bill, it is. You're right. 2020 was the year that wouldn't end. And we're glad it's in the rearview mirror for many reasons, not just political and otherwise. And so you're right. A lot of the issues and topics of discussion that we ended up with in 2020 led us into 2021 and the issues that we've dealt with while we've been in session for the last 3 months. So you're right. It feels like it's been about a year and a half continuous legislative session almost.
Yeah, right. Let's turn and talk a bit about the latest and what's happening with the election law. We know that, of course, Major League Baseball on Friday took a drastic step by pulling the All-Star game out of Atlanta. Governor Kemp had a quick and harsh reaction to that, as did many Republicans and even some Democrats as well. And we'll talk about that in just a second. But Jim Galloway, I want to start by reading just a paragraph from a piece that Politico put up on its website yesterday, because I think it tells us a lot about where Georgia stands in the national political dialogue right now. Here's what they say. The clash over Senate Bill 202, which is that big sprawling election bill, is thrusting Georgia back into the national spotlight after a tumultuous year. Ahmaud Arbery, a black man, was killed by white vigilantes. Rayshard Brooks, another black man, shot to death by police. Former President Donald Trump pressured local officials, election officials, to overturn his loss here. Then there was the March shooting targeting Asian Americans, and less than 2 weeks ago, the arrest of a black state legislator protesting the new law under the Gold Dome of Georgia's Capitol. The fight over the future of elections in Georgia, and some say the soul of the nation, is playing out on multiple fronts, materializing as not only a political, but also a legal battle, a legislative and moral battle as well. And now, as businesses from Coke to Delta condemn the law, and Republicans threaten to retaliate by zapping their tax breaks, it's become a corporate battle too. Jim, that about sums up Georgia in the national spotlight.
Right. It almost makes you long for the times when we were considered politically irrelevant, doesn't it? If I could start off the discussion with just with a few points here. Number one, I think in Governor Brian Kemp's Saturday reaction, his press conference, he pulled together a number of Republicans to stand behind him. I think the Major League Baseball has given him an issue that he can rally Republicans around and kind of dull the effect of the schism between himself and Trump supporters in the Republican base. But I will tell you what, I was talking to our friend Michael Thurman about this over the weekend, and to me one of the most interesting things about this development is that the Major League Baseball did what it did despite the warnings from local Democrats not to go there. You had Lisa Cupid, the chairwoman of the Cobb County Commission, say she didn't want to see a boycott of the game. Terry Inulowitz, a member of the House, said the same thing. Stacey Abrams said the same thing. And nonetheless, Major League Baseball did what it did. And to me, it tells you that this issue so-called voter security / suppression is a national issue. This is not a state issue, and you were seeing a national response by Major League Baseball. The other part of that is, I would say that the one thing to remember about the All-Star Game is, yes, it has the home run derby and a lot of hoopla around it, but it is strictly voluntary on the part of the players. We can cite instance after instance where a player was picked for the All-Star team and said, oh, no, I can't go because I've got this injury. I want to rest up for the week, and so I won't be attending. You can see that the players' union, there could have been a lot of pressure, much pressure on African American, on Hispanic players to boycott this event, and that would have been an extremely bad look on the part of the MLB.
All right, you said a lot there, and I want to unpack it and go back a step or two to do that. But I want to start with a more general idea here. One of the things I think has made it difficult for people, just observers out there, to understand how they feel about this law is that, as a couple of analysts have said in the last few days, this is a Rorschach test I mean, one side, Republicans primarily, read the law and say, thank goodness we finally have some rules in place that are going to assure us of responsible, trustworthy elections. Whereas, of course, Democrats say that there are so many aspects of this law which, in fact, will discourage voting among typically Democratic groups, minority groups. How do we unpack that? How do we even start off with a conversation in which the two sides are so diametrically opposed on what the law does?
Well, when you have a 98-page bill that was sort of rammed through the legislature, it is very hard for anybody to digest it, right? So one of the things about elections laws are they are extremely complicated. And on the face of this bill, one argument I've seen is, look, it expanded or codified things that weren't in law already. But the reality is the state Board of Elections was able to put into place rulings and procedures that expanded access to elections in 2020 and 2021. And codifying some of that language and the way in which it was codified is restrictive. And some of the arguments are, yes, it created uniformity. It added weekend voting for rural counties, but metro counties already had those weekend voting hours in place. And so there's some disingenuous arguments being made out there by the other side of the aisle that it does expand access to voting. But we know that it restricts it in terms of what we saw in 2020 and 2021, and especially for voters in metro counties. And then it creates a couple of dangerous precedences, including stripping the Secretary of State of his role, allowing the opening for the State Board of Elections to take over four counties at the same time. So if you target our four largest metro counties and we have a state board election takeover, that's a pretty dangerous precedent. The state local election boards are responsible for setting early voting locations, early voting hours. They're responsible for placing drop boxes. They're responsible for certifying elections. And then something we saw in 2021 was those massive voter challenges by a third-party group where they tried to roll off voters using a faulty method that we've seen before. It was along the lines of what the Trump lawsuit did, which was produce a list of voters' names using a faulty method and suggesting that they had moved out of state or they had double voted, those types of things. And so this new law allows those challenges, and it's an unlimited number of challenges. And the local election boards decide whether they take up those challenges or not. So that's rolling off voters. And the last thing I'll say is not counting provisional ballots out of precincts, that is enough to swing an election. If you look at the numbers in 2020, it was, I believe, 20,000 people who voted provisionally. And of those provisional ballots, 70% were Democratic voters. Because of precinct consolidations, because of confusion between early voting locations that were open on election day. And so this bill was really strategic in making sure it was chipping away at all the possibilities of reducing Democratic voters.
John Kennedy, I want to bring you in, obviously. Let me ask you, though, the same question. Can you understand why each side sees this new law as achieving different goals? Or how do you convince your constituents that Republicans have, in fact, voted for election security, not voter suppression?
Well, Bill, I would answer that question first by asking everyone, not just Republican voters, but everyone, to read the bill and become informed. This has been an incredible, seemingly coordinated effort to create a false narrative about what SB 202 does, so much so that we've seen examples of the President of the United States making comments about the bill and what it does that are just patently false, even to the point that I think we saw the Washington Post give some of his comments, what was it, four Pinocchios or whatever their grading system is, on making false statements. And it seems to be a very highly coordinated effort. But So to your question of how do we get folks to understand what's in it, I would encourage folks to read the bill, put it in context of where we were before 2020, look at what this bill does prospectively, and what does it do to secure elections going forward. To your question, Bill, do I understand how people can look at this and, as you approach it, have a different viewpoint? Yes, because we all look through things through the lens of our life experiences. I get that. But looking through that lens ought not to give you a distorted view of what the actual language of the bill is. And that seems to be what has been lost in this entire process. We hear comments being made. We hear things being said about what the bill does that's just simply not in there or completely false. And so from that standpoint, I do find it difficult. But I also think that it's worth stating that there seems to be this thought and approach to what we've tried to do. As you mentioned, Bill, you've got security almost on in one respect, and then you've got access in another. And those are not mutually exclusive. I don't view those to be on a continuum, that the more you're one, the less you're the other. And I think while this bill may not be perfect, as very few pieces of legislation that we pass are perfect, probably none are perfect. But I think this is a good effort to try to have a balanced approach to have additional security measures, but at the same time make sure that we got access. Because the truth is, we want everyone to vote. We want everyone who is eligible to legally cast a vote to vote.
Okay, so here, we are not going to be able to take each point in this law and talk about it on the show today, obviously, because it is 98 pages long. Maya, let me bring you into the conversation. Let's just take a couple of points and talk about how Bee and John Kennedy have interpreted them. So here's an example. This law, on one hand, it puts in law for the first time the fact that every county in Georgia will have drop boxes in which voters can put their absentee ballots. Republicans look at that and they say, look, we've never had a law that legalized drop box mandated drop boxes in every county. Democrats look at that and say, wait a minute. That law says that those drop boxes have to be inside advanced voting locations, that they can only be accessed during the hours that the polls are open, and that there has to be a security person standing by. The Democrats would argue, wait a second, why are drop boxes being treated differently than United States Postal Service mailboxes, for instance? That's one of those things that one side is going to see as suppressing the vote. The other side says, no, we're actually putting something in law that helps absentee voters.
Yeah, I think where for a lot of this election law, it comes down to how you feel about it. I remember, at the beginning of this debate, at the beginning of the year, a lot of Republicans who I spoke with who said they wanted to introduce different voting laws said that it was to assuage the feeling that something was wrong last year. And I think looking at how the voting went in November and January, with the, the historic vote for Democrats, for the president, and for Senate, now seeing those provisions that were put in place, like the drop boxes, being limited in some ways makes Democrats feel as though something is being taken away that, like you said, up until last year wasn't offered to them. I do, as a journalist, we are able to see both sides of things. Drop boxes will be available in places where they were not available last year. But I know for me, for example, I voted absentee in the primary and I used the drop box and I am a known procrastinator. And so I was walking up to the drop box at, that was outside of, I think it was a post office, at 6:50 on election day. And so I can see where each side gets their argument and how, like you said at the top of this, everyone is very emotional about it, and it can make it difficult to see things from the other side.
Jim?
Look, we've got a good situation here on the show this morning, and that is we have two lawyers, two state lawmakers who are also lawyers. And if they're not experts on election law, I think in the next year or so they're going to become so. One of the things that SB 202 did was that on January 5, both Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff won their runoffs, two Democrats. That broke a two-decade or a multi-decade streak for Republicans. And the chief difference, I think, there was for the first time we had runoffs that were 9 weeks after the general election instead of just 4 weeks. Republicans always had an advantage of that, in that they have older voters who don't need to be motivated quite so much to turn out. Okay, in 202 we return to that 4 week window, and we do that by allowing military voters overseas and other expatriates to vote in a system that automatically gives you a second choice. It's the automatic runoff situation. So my question to both B and John here is, can you actually treat one set of voters so differently than the mass of other voters? Is that something that's going to hold up in court? Because all other voters will be forced to turn out again on say the first Tuesday in December, be given a multiple choice ballot, if you will.
B.
I do want to respond to something that Senator Kennedy brought up earlier. The idea that this is a coordinated effort by Democrats with our messaging around whether this bill is good for voters or not. And the thing that I really think is critical to think about is it was a coordinated campaign on behalf of Republicans in every state and with the former president to sow those seeds of doubt early on as it relates to elections. So in 2020, we were sitting in committee meetings hearing from people that absentee ballot voting would open the door for voter fraud, yet no evidence has been produced from that very beginning, before the results of the primary, before the results of the general election. That was the messaging that was coordinated across the board, and no evidence to back that messaging up. It was very coordinated in the sense that Republicans felt they needed to sow seeds of doubt as it pertains to the election in case the president lost. And that would lend itself to the challenges that we saw, as well as the insurrection on January 6th. So that is where the coordinated piece goes. And that is why we're seeing almost every single state introduce restrictive laws. It's not a coincidence. So I think it's critically important to talk about that piece. And if you look at the bill, Senate Bill 202, it does include some of those efforts, including that conservative group that came to the local election boards trying to disqualify voters at the last minute in 2021. To me, that's the coordination that's going on. And that led to so many voters believing that there was some sort of fraud or the election wasn't free and fair. And in talking to some of my colleagues at the state house and on the Senate side, election laws are very complex. It is really hard for anyone to understand unless you're immersed in it. I've done hundreds of hours of voter protection, poll watching, ballot curing. And so that has given me some insight that some of my colleagues don't have around election laws, as well as working with DeKalb Elections Board to make sure that we were properly prepared for November and January 2021, because we weren't in June. A lot of election boards were not prepared to handle a pandemic. And in these conversations, people have asked me, sitting lawmakers have asked me questions like, well, Are absentee ballots and mail-in ballots the same thing, or are they different? No, they're the same. I mean, that's the lack of understanding. Have you ever cured a ballot before? No, I've never cured a ballot before. Have you ever poll monitored before? No, I've never poll monitored before. In fact, two of my Republican colleagues told me after all of these things that happened, they decided they were going to go poll watch in Fulton County on January 6th. And they said to me, B, those were extremely smooth operations. Nothing went wrong. We were very impressed by how Fulton handled the elections. And so I do think that that is important to say, because the understanding of elections is very different for different people in the General Assembly. And so making assertions without understanding exactly how election laws are made and how they impact people, it's just going to look a lot different for everybody.
John Kennedy, we have to get to a break, but I want to give you an opportunity before we do that to respond, to comment on what you're hearing. But let me put it in a context for you. We had essentially three counts of the Georgia vote after November, when the former president insisted over and over again that the election here was a fraud. And there was no indication whatsoever. The results kept turning out to be just about the same. And so one of the concerns, and maybe underlying all of the questioning about this new law, is the simple matter that we don't understand why there was a need to make these dramatic changes when the election, certainly in November, seemed to, and in January, seemed to unfold in a perfectly reasonable way. Senator?
A fair question, Bill, and I guess I would take issue with the question in this regard. I don't think these are dramatic changes that have been made, and maybe that's maybe for a part later in the show or another discussion, and that's inherently in part of what we're talking about. But I think, Bill, if you would also look at, and also to the representative's point about this coordinated effort, those talking points and the narrative about a rigged election or an analysis of problems that followed that really came out of the president's camp. If you think about the leaders of Georgia, you didn't really hear that. You certainly didn't hear the Secretary of State saying that. You didn't hear the governor saying that. Now, so I think it's a fair point to say you've got two sources of information on that particular issue, and I think they were different narratives. Secondly, just because even if you assume that we had a great election, it doesn't mean that we ought not to look at our laws on an occasional basis to see what sort of improvements we can make. Can we make improvements with regard to security? Can we make improvements with regard to access? And so both of those, I think, are something that we ought to be working on from time to time as society changes, as Georgia grows, as we come up with better ways to make it easier for people to vote, but at the same time making sure that we catch those that ought not be legally voting or can't legally vote, that those are properly excluded.
All right, let's do this. Thank you for that, Senator. Let's do this. Let's take our first break of the show and come back, and let's talk very specifically, because we're not going to be able to, as I said, go down point by point to everything that's in this law, and certainly not going to reach agreement on what the law actually does. So when we come back, let's talk about the news of Major League Baseball and some of the corporations that have now condemned the law, and talk about the political consequences that might follow. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Maya, on Friday, the Major League Baseball Commissioner Robert Manfred issued the following statement regarding the 2021 All-Star Game. He said, over the last week, we've engaged in thoughtful conversations with clubs, former and current players, the Players Association, among others, to listen to their views. I've decided that the best way to demonstrate our values as a sport is by relocating this year's All-Star Game and Major League Baseball draft. Interestingly, he made no comments about specific aspects of the law that troubled Major League Baseball. Also, interestingly, it's MLB is one of the most conservative of the sports organizations out there. So it's interesting they took this action. I want to talk about what they did, but before we do, I want to play Governor Kemp's response. He pulled together, I think relatively hastily, a group of Republicans to stand behind him at the Capitol and gave this forceful response to Major League Baseball.
Yesterday, Major League Baseball caved to fear and lies from liberal activists. They ignored the facts of our new election integrity law, and they ignored the consequences of their decision on our local community. Georgians and all Americans should know what this decision means. It means cancel culture and partisan activists are coming for your business. They're coming for your game or event in your hometown. And they're coming to cancel everything from sports to how you make a living. They don't care about jobs. They don't care about our communities. And they certainly don't care about access to the ballot box. It's easier to vote in Georgia than it is in New York. Even more ridiculous is that MLB didn't cite a single reason that they disagreed with the bill in their statement.
Maya, Major League Baseball acted after President Biden last week said in an interview that he would be perfectly fine if they decided to move the All-Star game. And what's so fascinating about this is it appears that Brian Kemp may have been handed an issue that can reunite Republicans who have been so divided over Donald Trump. Maya?
I mean, yeah, much of that speech was definitely a rallying call for Republicans and conservative residents in Georgia. It is, you know, I saw the response on Twitter, you know, people were saying, you know, this just guaranteed Brian Kemp will win the governor's race next year. You know, this is the rallying call that we needed to unite Republicans as we head into 2022 elections. You know, like you mentioned, it's interesting that Major League Baseball acted in the way that it did. I remember, and Senator Kennedy might remember, earlier this year, Senator Rules Chairman Jeff Mullis went to the well. I don't remember what specifically happened in sports that weekend. I hadn't watched, but he went to the well and did this, rant might not be the right word, but he went on about how he didn't like the way politics had seeped into the NFL and the NBA, and that in his house they did not watch the NFL or NBA anymore, but he appreciated the fact that baseball had stayed out of politics and that, you know, baseball was the only sport he was watching in his house. And so, you know, to go from that a few months ago to having baseball move the All-Star game, I personally was very surprised by the move. But in thinking about it, you have to remember last summer when there were all of these rallying calls around the movement for racial and social justice. And like Jim said earlier, many of these, the players on these teams are people of color, Black people, Hispanic people, people of color. And their commentary about the need for racial and social justice to come and face this national pressure to respond and to do something, it would have looked like everything that they said last year was kind of lip service. So it was interesting to watch it all play out and then also at the same time give Brian Kemp this issue for conservative voters to rally behind.
John Kennedy, the Major League Baseball decision was really a moment of some high drama in terms of pulling the All-Star game, but it follows Delta Airlines stepping out and saying they oppose this law, having said nothing before that. Other Georgia corporations now commenting on it, the Coca-Cola company now commenting on it. It does seem like Republicans in the state, John Kennedy, are behind the eight ball in terms of the a campaign now to condemn Georgia for passing this law.
Bill, unfortunately, I would have to agree, and that we are behind the narrative. And I think the reason for that is we were busy for the last 3 months trying to work on what ultimately became SB 202. And at the same time, I think there was a very carefully calculated design to come up with a narrative that, regardless of what the bill we would pass would ultimately be, it was going to be cast as oppressive. And I think you've seen that with regard to how the narrative unfolded, even when we were considering different versions of the bill. And I think we also ought to stop and think, this is not just a Georgia issue. While we clearly are under the microscope, I think part of what you're seeing and why you see MLD doing this is there are multiple other state legislatures around the country that are still in session or have yet to go into session, and they too are going to be considering election bills. And I think this is part of a narrative to try to for those states as well, say, hey, you better not be talking about or changing the laws to try to improve security, or even if you're rather vanilla about it, we're going to do things that put your state in peril. And I think, Bill, what has happened here with MLB is just incredibly unfortunate. It's been done without any regard to the effect that this will have on all businesses. But I think there's a common thread that you mentioned with regard to MLB's response. You mentioned Delta some other organizations, and that is, if you listen to what they're saying, it is completely without any details. It's a vague general complaint without specifics of what the real problem is that they in particular may or may not have with the bill. And I think when you put that in context with the history of the work that was done to get the bill to where it is, and you read the bill and you look at the details, you see that it's one of those that they don't want to get into a discussion of the specifics. Why MLB made the decision they did is beyond me. It's very disappointing, and it's unfortunate. And I think, as you said, even many Democrats have come out and said this is really sad and bad for Georgia.
Well, Jim, and then B, I mean, I think one of the reasons it's pretty clear that MLB made the decision they did is that this has now been framed fairly pretty successfully as a civil and human rights issue, maybe correctly. I mean, again, that's all a matter of how you interpret this law. But you can't very well have an MLB All-Star game honoring Hank Aaron if you frame the Georgia law as a violation of the civil rights of African Americans who fought for the right to vote in Georgia for well over a century.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple things to unpack here, Bill. Number one, I'd agree with Senator Kennedy. I think this was a move aimed at a post Georgia audience, at the various state legislators, saying that you shouldn't go to this place. Now, as far as the lack of detail from Coke and from Delta and specific objections, I think part of that is because the problem with this legislation is largely in its origin, and rather than the results, that the origin of this bill was, as Ms. Wynn has pointed out, was the objections raised by Donald Trump after his November 3rd defeat. And also, the other part of this is that, look, there is quite a bit of sleight of hand that goes on in the legislature. you had multiple bills, I mean dozens of bills introduced this session, and you didn't know which one was going to pass, what provision was going to be in, what provision was going to be out. When 202 was finally passed, I think at, 5:30 one evening, just before, earlier this month, you know, it was signed into law. A 98-page bill was signed into law 45 minutes later by the governor. You know, it wasn't a situation where corporations knew what was going into that bill. It's something that they had to kind of evaluate.
I'm not on the same page as Jim. It's a 98-page bill that has been changed so many times, and quite frankly, so many people have read the bill. I want to say this: lawmakers who have spoken up about this bill, we have read the bill. So reject the notion that people have not read the bill, as well as many organizations who are on the ground 365 days a year protecting the right to vote for voters. And the reality is, it was signed into law very rapidly behind closed doors with all white men under a picture of a plantation. And I met the woman whose father was a sharecropper on that plantation. And she said to me, my dad brought me back there. He was a sharecropper there, and I can't believe that was the photo that was used for this signing that would affect my right to vote. And so when we talk about how things impact us, it is very clear that Black and brown people believe legitimately, because they have had to fight for the right to vote, have had to stand in 11-hour lines, have had their ballots rejected at a higher rate, they believe and understand that this law will disproportionately impact them. And that's the reality for people of color. It is just a different reality. As far as the boycotts go, you know, I personally am not calling for boycotts because, again, we know this is going to impact workers. But I do understand and recognize the importance of corporate responsibility and the way that that has changed over time. And if we think about the civil rights movement, Coca-Cola did have to step in to allow that dinner to be held in Atlanta to honor MLK. And when corporations last summer started issuing statements of diversity and inclusion surrounding the Black Lives Matter movement, we do want to see them put their money where their mouth is. But putting their money where their mouth is looks differently, I think, for some of us. Instead of boycott and taking events out of Georgia, which we knew would probably happen, we saw that with bills in the past, with RFRA, for example. If you pass this discriminatory RFRA bill, businesses are going to pull out. But the reality is, what I would like to see is more investment in the state of Georgia. Don't leave us. Invest in our infrastructure. Do what you can to make sure that if this law stays in place, there are four lawsuits right now, that voters are still going to be able to access the poll and access them easily.
All right. I've got to get to our final break, and I really want to look at a couple of other issues on the show today. But before I do, John Kennedy, I do want to close this conversation, which will continue in the days ahead, obviously, with our panels about the election law, with Nate Cohen's piece in the New York Times. Nate Cohen being one of the great data crunchers in journalism. And he says this, Senator Kennedy, there's essentially no evidence that the vast expansion of no-excuse absentee mail voting, in which anyone can apply for a mail absentee ballot, had any discernible effect on turnout in 2020, which is what Alan Abramowitz has been saying on our show. Nate Cohen says that turnout has increased by maybe 2% with no discernible advantage in the 2020 election for Republicans or Democrats. And he goes on to say that a study at Stanford found that no excuse mail voting might have increased turnout by 0.02% in the 2020 election. All of that suggests, Senator, that the storm of controversy created by this law may in fact end up having almost no effect on the 2022 election outcomes.
Bill, I think there's a lot that you put in there, and to unpack it a little bit, I would agree. It sort of calls into question why this this reaction that we've seen with regard to these changes, which are quite frankly very minor and also address some of the issues that I think most objective observers realize that we have with absentee ballots. I mean, if you look at the core issue of when one goes to vote in person, there's two things in essence that you have to prove: that number one, you are who you say you are, and that number two, you're voting in a way that is not being influenced by or directed by someone else. Both of those are absent with an absentee ballot. And so the system we had with regard to signature verification was based on an effort to try to make it secure, but it was not a good process. And so what we've gone to is a way that makes it more identifiable and increases the likelihood that the person who's sending in the ballot is in fact that person.
Okay, we're going to get to a break, and when we come back, we'll have a little time to talk about a couple other issues.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
On Political Rewind. We are really down to the wire on today's Political Rewind, but Jim Galloway, while all of this about the election law was dominating the headlines, the Supreme Court of the United States made a decision that is of great importance to many in Middle and South Georgia. They have ruled in Georgia's favor on the water wars and have said that Georgia can continue to draw water. It's especially important for farmers in Middle and South Georgia, despite Florida's insistence that it is hurting the oyster production, oyster farmers down in Apalachicola. That's an important decision for Georgia.
It's an important decision and a long time coming. There have been decades of legal wrangling over this, and most important, I think it underlines the fact that Metro Atlanta is only going to grow bigger and bigger and bigger in terms commercially and in terms of political influence.
Most importantly, right now, this decision does in fact give the farmers down your way, John Kennedy, much more relief in terms of how much water they're using for watering their crops.
Bill, you're absolutely right. This is a huge decision for Georgia. It will most directly impact a lot of the agricultural community and farmers in my area and in South Georgia. The great concern from how the decision may have turned had it taken a different path was very concerning to farmers and had the whole agricultural community, quite frankly, on edge. And so we're grateful for the well-reasoned decision, not just from the court, but it's also consistent with what the mediator or the arbitrator had recommended leading up to this. So it's been a long path that, quite frankly, Georgia has won pretty much at every step of the way, and hopefully this is the end of it now for us.
B, I want to ask you, as we run out of time, about what you see as any of the victories. If you had an opportunity to just talk about one thing that you think you were able to accomplish in the legislature, you as members, for the good of this state, what would you point to? Would you say it was citizens' arrest? Would you say it was the speaker's last-minute effort to block the expansion of carry laws in the state of Georgia? What's a good thing that came out of this session, Dee?
I certainly think the repeal of citizens' arrest is probably the thing that was most important that came out of this session. I remember last year, Jim, we headed out of town to the mountains and came back early because of the shooting of Rayshard Brooks. And it was, you know, during the height of Black Lives Matter protests over the summer. And, you know, that continued to carry on. And one of the things that I worked on last year when we came back into session, I sat down with Representative Abstraction, Marissa Dodson from Southern Center for Human Rights and Georgia NAACP and said, how can we get this repealed? And so I was very grateful to see that happen. And I do think that to see the bipartisanship around it, to see Burt Reeves carry it, and he said to me it was probably the single most important thing he's done, and he was very emotional, and he said it took a learning curve for him to understand why it was so important to repeal that law.
Maya, I mentioned the carry law that would have expanded the rights of people from out of state to carry in Georgia based on their own state's laws about concealed weapons. The Senate wanted that to go through. The Speaker blocked it at the last minute. Some would say because he's trying to appeal to his more moderate Republicans out there in suburban Atlanta.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, one thing that the Speaker is very good at. It is at protecting his majority in the chamber. He works very hard to do that, and he lets Metro Atlanta Republicans carry legislation like citizens' arrest, like hate crimes that bolster their support with more moderate voters. And I definitely think that even with redistricting and what districts might look like next year, he understands that there are still growing numbers of Democrats and more moderate voters in Metro Atlanta that might make it more difficult for his Republican members.
Last word of the show for you today, Maya. And thank you, by the way, for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you, Maya Prabhu, on today's show. B. Nguyen, we appreciated your being here. Senator John Kennedy, thank you as well. And Jim Galloway, glad to have you on another Monday on Political Rewind. That's it for us for today. We'll be back, of course, with a brand new show tomorrow. I hope my audio will be fixed so you don't have to put up with me on this terrible phone line. In the meantime, take care, stay healthy, continue wearing your masks, and find a place to get vaccinated. See y'all tomorrow.